Five, four, three, two, one.
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
All right, that's pretty good. That's the best one yet.
Pizza, pizza.
Big O! Showtime!
Well, you were making egg foo young in the kitchen. I was in the dining room having sushi.
It was with my mouth.
It's a little thing, Tech Show, and that's a fact. If you don't like the cast, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies that a Lincoln bat. For the stolen, go direct to DLNGS.org. And the IC challenge of Linux.net. Bound Tech Show. Just sit right there, cause the castle's just about to begin.
Welcome to episode 864 of the Linux Link Tech Show. On the show tonight, we have Pat.
Happy July.
We have Rich.
From the Hughes Compound Southern Command. Oh, I mean Fraz, Flying Rich Autonomous Zone.
And we have Joe.
Hello.
And Joel said he'll be a little bit later. But
yay! I mean, oh.
So, I guess, you know, since we have you, are you still eating, Rich?
No, I'm running into my office.
Okay, since we have you right now, and there was a request for this, why don't you tell us about your airplane crashes, both of them, and the excitement that ensued thereafter?
Boy, you know, it's kind of funny. I haven't told any of these stories in a long time. Hopefully I remember them.
How do you forget crashing a plane?
Because he crashed the plane, man, twice.
I didn't crash a plane twice. I crashed two planes twice, or one plane each time. So, I do like referring to saying my first plane crash, and or you know, doing it like that. So, anyhow, if you go to youtube.com/flyingrichinaviation, you can see videos, like news videos of it. And of course, there is actually one in-camera brake failure. So I'm a 1,000-hour instrument-rated pilot. I haven't had flying money in a long time, so I haven't actually flown in a while. But, I'm getting a note. Please take the recyclable down. Oh, okay, that's urgent. Yep. So, all right, so the first plane crash happened on Long Island, and it was post, let's see, what year was it? I gotta remember back what year. But I actually, all the New York papers had stories of it. I was on the front cover of Newsday, and it actually said I dipped the stock market on news of the plane crash. So, I kind of famous, not, but anyhow, I was coming in for a landing at Isaac MacArthur Airport. I'd flown out to like Montauk and back, and my engine failed as I'm coming in for an approach on the landing. I didn't realize, your engine goes out, you're not doing all the math right in your head. So I'm like, all right, I'm on glide slope. I'll just look stupid pushing my plane off the end of the runway when I land. I didn't compute the 30-knot headwind, or the, 27-knot headwind, which meant I was going to be about a mile short of the runway. And even though I think it was November, there's enough trees around that you really can't see where there are roads and where there aren't roads. And if you've only taken off and landed on runways, anything that doesn't look like a runway doesn't look like a good place to land. And you land, when you line up for a runway, you line up heading into the wind. So as I'm coming in, I could see like there's a golf course, but the golf course was kind of north and south. So if you land heading into the wind, let's say you have a 30-knot headwind and my landing speed is about 80 miles an hour, my touchdown speed is going to be 50 miles an hour. If I land with the wind, heading west, I'm going to be coming down, my touchdown speed is going to be like 110 miles an hour. So it's a big difference when you land into the wind versus not. So that's a big deal of basically, energy and survivability. So, I'm flying a Canard Cozy 3. So basically the plane, they don't want to say it's stall proof, but it's stall resistant. So what happens to most pilots flying a Cessna is you lose the engine, even though a Cessna lands at like 40 something miles an hour, like with full flaps. A lot of pilots still die, even though it's a lightweight plane, very low energy, and you pretty much put it down anywhere, reasonably within 500 feet. And most pilots get nervous, pull back too far on the stick, stall it aerodynamically, meaning it doesn't have any more lift, and they die because it falls out of the sky like a brick. My plane is different, that you can pull full aft stick and it won't stall because the forward wing stalls first and then the nose drops. And even if you got into a deep stall where the main wing stalls, it would fall, I think like between 500, 700 feet per minute, and it's actually survivable. So even if you deep stalled it. So I'm coming in and I'm aiming for, you know, trying to get to a road. I had to make kind of a dogleg, you know, trying to get over to a road. My main gear hit the roof of a house, knocked a hole in the roof. And, you know, we're talking residential neighborhood. So, let's see. I guess this is the shortest landing I ever made. So pretty much came down like at a 45 degree angle. Somehow the plane ended up backwards, spun at least 180 degrees, and it probably tumbled also. I don't know for sure because the wings were folded up around it. So if you actually look at the video, so youtube.com/flyingrich and go to the aviation playlist, the wings are like wrapped around the plane, the Lexan canopy, so it's kind of like an F-16 bubble, was torn out as I went through the tree, so I don't even know why I have a face. And when the left wing got tore off the fuselage, my left foot was on the rudder pedal, and that, like, drove my knee through the instrument panel, and I fractured my tibia plateau and injured my ankle. So that was the major injury, and typically if you fracture your tibia plateau, you never walk again. It was, like, really on the outside of the joint, so it wasn't that bad. So I was crazy lucky. I got out of the plane, looked back, and I'm like, nobody survives that. So if you guys take a look at that picture, it's pretty freaking scary. A little
Did
bit of physical therapy.
Again?
No, I'm talking about the first crash because somebody wrote an email and asked about, you know, plane crashes and stuff like that because we joke about it an awful lot on the show, and I guess we've never really talked about it. So the first plane was not rebuildable. You'd be real stupid to rebuild that plane. The second plane, I was flying from Monroe, Louisiana, where they filmed Duck Dynasty, and I was heading up to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And I was at like 4,000 feet over Pine Bluff, Arkansas, and the canopy flew open, and basically it's a pusher prop. So pretty much identical plane. Something went through the prop as it flew out of the cockpit because I was doing, you know, like 175 miles an hour. And it took off about a foot of propeller. You know, it's a wooden blade. It's a fiberglass wrapped wooden propeller, which actually isn't uncommon in aviation. There's a lot of aluminum props, but like MT Propellers, which is a famous German propeller manufacturer, they're wooden core with a fiberglass wrap. Made the whole everything really unbalanced, which, so the dumb thing is, you know, you look back, I was like, what the hell? Because you want to see what's wrong. And I'm like, jackass, there's nothing you're going to fix. Doesn't matter what's wrong, you know? It took me a minute to, you know, punch in nearest on the GPS and find the nearest airport. I think it was like 16 miles out. And I closed to within, I think, like 6 or 7 nautical miles of the airport. And I'm flying with very little engine power. In fact, I probably should have just shut the engine down. And because it was vibrating, it broke off the exhaust manifolds, which started cooking the canopy. So I could, even though the canopy was open, you wouldn't think I'd be able to smell it because the air would be rushing by me. You know, like, why would I smell something behind me? But I could smell the fiberglass burning. And again, I wanted to look back, and I'm like, I don't care. You know, I said to myself, I don't care if you got a 50-foot rooster tail of fire. It doesn't matter. Don't look back. You got to fly the plane and land it. And so being at 4,000 feet in an emergency situation, as opposed to, you know, when I was coming in for landing, it takes you a while to get down. And it's exhausting, you know, mentally, physically draining and exhausting. And I'm like, at one point I was like, geez, I just want to give up. I'm like, yeah, it's all up to you. You got to make this. And, so the NTSB guy, and I'll tell the full story about that. He's asking like, well, what altitude were you when you knew you had to land on the road? I'm like, I don't know. Didn't look at the instruments. He's like, what airspeed were you? I'm like, I don't know. Whatever it took to keep the plane flying, you know? I seriously just absolutely zero instruments, staring straight out the window, you know, or no window, sorry, because there was no canopy anymore. Just said, hey, you know, whatever it takes to keep the plane flying. And I've got 600 hours in that type of airplane, so I think I know it real well. I was able to land on the road, but I didn't realize I took out a power wire with my main gear. My right wing hit a speed limit, stop sign. My right wing hit a stop sign, and it's two lanes in either direction with a turn lane. And this is in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. And so there was a car in the left-hand lane, and my left wing hit the car. I ended up in the ditch, you know, drainage ditch, and, like a speed limit sign took out like the left strake and left, part of the left wing on the plane. Oh, the left canard also. And, so one of my fuel tanks was broken, but, you know, no fires in both accidents. I scratched my finger on the second accident, so that I'm getting better at it. And as far as energy goes, my phone was sitting on my passenger seat and it was still there. It's not like, you know, you'll drive down the road and you'll have your phone on the passenger seat and you'll hit the brakes and you'll launch the phone into the footwell. That didn't even happen. But the people in the car all had back and neck injuries and they had to go to the hospital. which I'm sure they were thinking about the big insurance payoff because they're getting hit by an airplane. And pretty much we
did that make your insurance go up for flying or whatever?
Well, I haven't had insurance for flying since, because I haven't owned an airplane or a flying airplane since, let me say it that way. So yeah, I'm sure my rates would be really bad. And I only had liability on the first, so I didn't tell you the best part of the first story. So I bought the first plane for $20,000. But had hull insurance on it for 60. So I actually made $40,000 on the first crash. Second crash, I only had liability, so I didn't make anything. But it covered the damages. So it covered, you know, like rewiring the telephone poles, putting up new stop signs and speed limit signs and stuff like that. A flatbed truck came and we put the plane, you know, fully assembled. We didn't have to take the wings off and we put it on the flatbed truck and, you know, just regular car flatbed, brought it to the airport. And, it's funny. So when you crash into a neighborhood, the cops don't know what to do. Like they know if you're speeding, what to do. They know if you got a DWI, what to do. So like it was cold and I go into the plane to get, you know, like a jacket. Cops like, there's a crime scene. I'm like, this is my plane. That's my luggage. I'm getting my jacket and putting it on. And I guess the cop was never talked to that way, you know? And then the same cop hands me the phone and it's the FAA. And they say, you will be in Little Rock, Arkansas tomorrow at 9 a.m. And I'm like, dude, I'm a IT consultant. I am leaving this town as soon as possible and getting back to Rochester, Minnesota to my job. And if you want to talk to me there, I will make myself available to you. So, you know, and this guy, oh my gosh, I don't remember the guy's name, but, he had a cool, he lived in a hangar at the airport. So very cool. The guy was a doctor and he wrote a book, And actually, I got to kick it around here somewhere. It's not unpacked in my house in Florida, though. Super nice guy. Took me out to dinner, got me liquored up, because you need to get liquored up after that, because you're not going to sleep otherwise. And he drove me like 2.5 or 3 hours to the airport to get me on a plane out of town, which was fantastic. When I got off the flight in Minneapolis, like, the phone rings, it's at the NTSB. And the NTSB guy is like, "You even get a Bobo you have to put a Band-Aid on?" I'm like, "Yeah, I got a Bobo, but I didn't put a Band-Aid on it." So the accident report says minor injuries. But actually, both accident reports say minor injuries. So that is the tale. My plane is still in Minneapolis in pieces. And if I ever get the money again, I'm going to put it together and fly it.
Next thing you know, he's 3D printing a plane.
Yeah, 3D printing's got to come a long way to somebody. There was a 3D printed plane project, but
now, is your license still valid, or do you have to go through some kind of renewal process? Or
okay, so that's a whole cool thing in itself. All right, so your license, quote unquote, your pilot's license, really is technically a pilot certificate, and the pilot certificate is only valid with an accompanying medical that's current and a biannual flight review. So, and there's the term, and I think it's helped me to understand a lot of things. It's like when I was in college, I loved Pascal, but I haven't done Pascal in 20, 30 years, so I'd probably suck at it. So in aviation, there's always the term current. Are you current with? Meaning in the last 30, 60, 90 days, have you done, 3 takeoffs and landings and that type of aircraft in day and night situations? And it's helped me understand some things with life that you may have been a great water skier in your 20s, but you haven't water skied in 30 years. So you may suck at it now or, whatever skill set it is. But, so, couple of things have to be valid. One, you have to have a pilot certificate. I'm an instrument rated pilot, but my instrument rating isn't valid unless I've done so many approaches in the last 30, 60, 90 days, and I'd have to look it up. I have to have a medical, and I have to have a biannual flight review. So the other part of that is in either of these situations, the FAA could have asked me to do a check ride and demonstrate my flying skills. But my flying skills are in COSI 3 experimental aircraft. So technically, they would have to find somebody who's a flight instructor with a COSI 3 and have me demonstrate that I was still proficient in that aircraft. So it's kind of a catch. Maybe if it was a Cessna, they might have asked me for a check ride. But the NTSB guy, basically he said on my Arkansas accident, he's like, the FAA, they probably just want to mouth kiss you. You put that plane down, nobody got injured, and, or let's just say nobody with real injuries. They did have substantial back and neck pains. But so realistically, the only time the FAA really cares about stuff is when other people's property or people are injured. Otherwise, it's not a big deal.
Like if you crash your drone into something and it destroys it.
Which, everybody's up in arms about drones. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of.
Yeah, I know. Yep. One of these days I need to go get my part 107, but...
It's been a stupid argument basically since drones started getting popular.
Yep.
Now, did they need some kind of laws preventing certain actions with drones? Probably.
Well, my whole thing is technically you're supposed to call your flight plan into the air before you take your drone off, but nobody does.
I mean, if you're not flying any higher than a kite.
They recommend a VFR flight plan, but if you file a VFR flight plan and don't close your VFR flight plan, they will send a search and rescue crew out and bill you for it. So nobody files the VFR flight plan. IFR flight plans are automatically closed by the tower.
Right.
So you don't have to do that. So you have to file an IFR flight plan, which is instrument flight rules. VFR is visual flight rules. But yeah, this is...
In most cases, if you stay below the limit, which is in the case of drone flights, 400 feet,
yeah,
and your line of sight, you're good.
So I kind of got caught on the hype of, you know, they all say you could be rich and famous if you get your drone license.
Right.
And as a pilot, it actually cost me nothing to get my drone certification. So even though I've never flown a quadcopter, I've flown things that are much harder to fly, you know, RC helicopters and RC planes.
No. Go ahead.
I have a drone license.
You have your 107. Yeah.
And all I had to do is have my flight instructor, you know, sign a document. And they have this retard test. It's awful. So you do this online training and like an online test. And I'm like, oh, I got an 80. Okay. No, you got to go back and do it over until you get 100. I'm like, really? I'm like, it's not like, oh, I have to pay or I have to wait an hour or 2 hours or I can literally take it twice in 24. I'm like, really? That's it? So it was kind of anticlimactic, and I hate to say it, they make such a big hype about, you know, get a drone license and you'll make all sorts of money.
Now, there's my question. How are you making money with a drone license unless you're living on, like, the Mexican border?
Well, there are real estate, ways.
So no, don't get me wrong. I understand. I understand that there are ways to make money. It's just not everybody with a drone license is going to be able to make that kind of money. Okay, taking real estate pictures. That's one. Drone racing, that's another. But, you know, not everybody's going to be able to do both.
Either. So the only reason you need a drone license is if you're actually doing something for money. So
commercial, right.
Yeah, if you're taking real estate video,
if you're flying for Amazon to deliver packages, which could happen, but yeah.
And so there's, right now there's a line of sight regulation, so you can't fly further than you can see it. Other countries have, they allow you not to do, or to do without, I should say, line of sight. So it's probably going to be a couple of years, and we're probably going to have states that, you know, go into a test phase or whatever that allow, you know, non-line of sight. And then the next stage would be like semi-autonomous, where maybe one drone operator operates, you know, more than one drone at a time.
Right. Well, you already have drones.
Maybe they're autonomous.
Yeah, you already have drones that are mostly autonomous.
Right.
I mean, they get programmed. They have a certain route.
My Mavic can do it.
Yeah, exactly.
My Mavic can track, like, one thing I haven't actually tried this, but you can actually set a follow me mode. And I've seen people that will set follow me on their car. And then they'll drive along and the drone will follow them as it records you driving, which I haven't done that mostly because, that little line of sight thing. And, you know, in that way, I really wouldn't see the drone while I'm, you know, the only way I would do that is if somebody else was driving the vehicle. But things like that, like I can have it fly patterns. I have done that before. Other things, like one of my favorite modes is what they call quick shot mode, which basically you place it where you want to start it and you press a button and it counts down. You basically draw a box around what you want it to focus on. And then it says like 3, 2, 1, and then it starts to basically back away from what you're videoing, or videoing in this case, And then not only does it back away, but it also increases altitude. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't go up to the limit. It just goes only so far up, and then it's done. So that's technically an automated kind of thing, because, you know, you're not controlling it when it's doing that. Your sticks are vertical when you do that. But, you know, there's other things too. Real estate is a good one. I'm wondering if surveyors would start using it. Probably not, because there wouldn't not be, at least, not for their final estimates, but, you know, because we really wouldn't be terribly accurate, but.
Well, if you're doing, you know, TV or commercial production,
that too,
actual video or photography, so basically anything other than hobbyist type stuff, you're required to have a license for, which it's kind of dumb to me. Yep. You know, it's kind of like, you know, having your plumber's license and, you know, you, as opposed to being an apprentice for 4 or 5 years to get your license. So, I hate to say it, I think somebody could be an excellent plumber, watched a whole bunch of YouTube videos, read a couple of books on it, and doesn't need to be an apprentice for 4 or 5 years to some guy that, you know, apprenticed 20 or 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. Not that I think apprenticeships are a waste of time, but I'm kind of libertarian on this concept that, you know what? Let him say he's a plumber. If he sucks, people will figure it out. It's the internet age.
Yep.
You know, we'll all know he sucks at plumbing.
Oh, and you'll know all too well, because somebody will go whine and bitch and moan on Twitter. Or next door or something like, okay, this is that time of year. You know, this is the week of 4th of July. You know, I'm off Friday. I don't know how about you guys, but I am. But
I'm not.
But if you look on the Nextdoor app, which is a social network for hyperlocal, so basically it's just for people in your area. Fortunately, they do.
Wait, Joel, you mean the Karen app?
Yeah, basically, yeah. Yeah, I mean, because the one thing that I guarantee you in my neighborhood, especially this time of year, one thing you'll always see is people bitching about fireworks. You know, I'm not saying that they're not right, you know, because technically they're illegal, but it's like, dude, it's summer. You're going to get that from May until September, okay? You know,
so
my dog,
this is a much
I'm like,
longer
I understand
story
that,
it,
yeah.
I'll give you the Reader's Digest version of the story, but there was a BLM march in my neighborhood. And it was like 40 people when it started raining, 12 people ran back to their cars. And towards the end of the march, basically it was all white soccer moms and their kids. And there were a handful of people of color. And then they announced that they're going to be doing another like BLM march. And I think I've heard reports of 1 to 3 people showed up, you know, and I live
gotta
in a neighborhood.
Gotta be just where you live, but anyway.
Yeah, well, in my neighborhood, it's the smallest piece of property you can have is 1.25 acres. And it's Jupiter Farms, and it's, you know, rednecks. And I'm not saying rednecks are good or bad people or whatever, but a lot of people here are just like me. You know, somebody that, hey, they couldn't afford a house on the beach or a house in, you know, a fancy exclusive neighborhood, but they could afford, you know, a decent house on a nice piece of property in, you know, this redneck stretch of woods here. And, you know, and look, there's 3-4 houses down. There's some not so nice houses. Not that they're awful, but they're, you know, not as nice as the nicest houses on the block. So I just want to say, I don't know you guys' experience, but I don't know anybody that's a racist. I don't know any racists. So
yeah.
I'm kind of shocked.
Well, I'd
at
really
this stuff.
Not like to go into this subject, but you know, the Karen app though, I mean, to bring it back to that, it's like, so that's one thing you'll always see is that kind of stuff. And you'll see people complaining. You know, they didn't really complain too much about the protests downtown. But that's because hardly anybody lives down there. It's all office buildings and stuff like that for the most part. There's some condos, but the other thing is, for gosh, probably since before we moved here 20 some years ago, surrounding our neighborhood are quarries. There's a quarry, two or three quarries over by 71. There's some that's to the south.
So is it like sand or granite? What kind of quarries?
Limestone. Mostly. Okay. Yeah, so at least once a day, one of the quarries, it's not always the same one, but one of the quarries will blast. All right. The whole friggin' neighborhood shakes and you see Karen's, my house is going to be your house is not going to be damaged by it. If it was, then the state and the actually I found out ODNR actually controls that, Ohio Department of Natural Resources. They're the ones that regulate how, you know, like how often and, you know, and they monitor that kind of stuff. But people complain about
it. You move into a neighborhood where there's quarries and then you complain about them blasting.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's kind of like moving next to an airport complaining about the airplane noise.
I'm used to it. It's like usually when if I hear it, I'll look at the wife and says, oh boy, here comes all the complainers on next door. Now it didn't always happen, but.
So.
Another thing that you'll hear that same kind of sound, it's sounding like blasting will also happen, when the rail yard, not too awfully far from here, when they're connecting cars, you'll hear a BAM! It sounds like a bomb going off, but it's just them. It's like, calm down, man.
So my house in New York, bad. I'm, you know, basically down the block from the tracks. The tracks were basically behind my house, and I'm sure every 25, 30 minutes a train went by. I would swear to you on a stack of Bibles that no trains went by. Because I just don't hear them anymore. It just
Yeah, that's the way it's always been for me. I've lived next to railroad tracks. I've lived next to airstrips. I've lived next to artillery fields. It's just you learn to just pause your conversation and then pick it up like you never stopped.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, it's like we first moved from I'm trying to remember. We were going from Berwick, Pennsylvania, where my dad at that time he worked on his company was building a diesel generator for a Susquehanna Steam Electric Plant, which is a nuclear plant near Berwick, Pennsylvania. So we went from there to go down to Scott Paper, which they were building a it's the toilet paper Scott Paper. They were building a cogeneration plant, so basically instead of throwing all their trash into the landfill, they were burning it and making energy from it. Okay. So anyway, we just moved into that area, Essington, Pennsylvania. Essington, Pennsylvania is just to the south of Philly International Airport and to the north of Delaware. Okay. We always made trips to Delaware to go shopping because there was no sales tax in Delaware. But anyway, first night we're in the house, dad got the bed set up and all that stuff. He's sleeping. He has to work the next day. Okay. The deck was pretty low going into Philly International. So I don't know what plane. It could have been DC-9, could have been 737. I have no idea what kind of plane it was. Goes over our house, and it was so light, and it did shake the house. My mom said that dad stood up in bed and said, "What the bleep is that?" And then went right back to sleep. And that happened once or twice, but after a while, my dad he didn't give a crap, you know. Because, you know, it's what happens when you live, you know, less than a mile from the end of Philly International's departure. We also happen to live the town we lived in also happened to, I don't even know if it's active anymore, but the Philadelphia seaplane airport was right in our town. Basically, there was a stretch of the Delaware River where the seaplanes would take off. That was actually pretty interesting, because I didn't go into it, but they had an explorers and scouts were basically the older kids towards the tail end of their scouting career, and you can be above 18 too, and it'll be more career focused. Like there was an explorer group with law enforcement, there's one with fire departments and stuff like that. I don't even know if that exists anymore. Used to. It also was probably the first one of the scouting groups that allowed girls to be in it too. And that was like back in the 80s when that happened. But that was, you know, I imagine if somebody moved into that area, never lived in that area before, you'd probably see similar posts about that. Maybe you need to do something about those airplanes flying. No, the airport has been there well before you moved in there, sweetie. They're not going to do anything about it. Just like I tell people who are bitching about the fireworks, I'm like, I think the police department has a little bit more important things to do than chase around all the people that are selling off their fireworks. They bought down a Phantom Fireworks in the same state. Yeah. That's funny. You can buy them here, and you actually have to sign a thing. Like when you buy them, you have to sign a form that says that you're not going to set them off in the state of Ohio. But I guarantee you almost everybody who buys them there sets them off here. And from what I've heard, they're having a record year too because of the virus. Is there any community firework displays? Nowhere that I know of around here except for maybe West Jeff.
Dude, all on the east coast of Florida here, as far as I know, no fireworks, and they close the beach for the holiday weekend. So all the counties on
or
the
swimming
coast.
Pools too, yep. Our swimming pools,
no,
most of them aren't open.
A water park, as far as I know, it's open. You know, it's a private, not publicly owned. It's a private water park.
Because of the virus, most of the local swimming pools are closed, and that also makes me feel privileged to know my brother-in-law, who has a swimming pool at his house. We're going to go up there Saturday. So,
my swimming pool is probably like 85 degrees, 87 degrees. Nobody goes in it.
Nah, that's too hot.
Oh, yeah, my wife will go until it's like 90.
But yeah, we're supposed to have like we got a bad stretch of temps coming up here in Ohio. I know Joe's gonna tell me stop your bitching. It's been 90 degrees for the last month here. But starting Friday through Tuesday next week, it's going to be above 90 or close to 90 almost every day. It's going to be close to that tomorrow, too. So, I still haven't heard back from, we have air conditioning, but the drip pan below the coils, it's melted. Somehow.
Did you just get that fixed?
No, I did. No, I did. They just haven't fixed that part yet.
Oh.
So
the
basically,
drip pan is melted?
Yeah, I don't know how that happened.
What was dripping into it? Lava?
Oh, really. No, it's just that's the drip pan for the condensation, you know,
right.
From the coils. So the only thing I can figure is well, I don't know why. I really don't have an answer why. But, and it's, according to the tech, there's about a 20% chance they can actually find the replacement part. It's actually pretty rare from what they said. And then, the next thing is they can make one, or we can replace the coils, which is like $1,000, or a new system, which is only going to be right around $5,000 is what they said. So. I don't know. But I can tell you this. It is on the short list of stuff we're probably going to end up having to replace, but.
Oh, yoy, yoy. How old's that air conditioner?
Oh, it's over 20 years old.
Oh, there you go. There's a problem,
23-year-old.
Right?
It's 23 years old, dude. It was new when we moved into the house. So we've been here, let's see, we got married in 97. So we've been married 23 years. We've got, had Luke in, well, bought the house in 98, had Luke in 99. And we're done with kids. So. We're done with kids because my wife's already gone through the change, baby.
I'm glad. I'm sure she's happy that you told everybody.
Oh, hell. She doesn't give a shit.
Hi. You know what? I'll tell you what. My wife's been doing, for the past couple of years, a lot of gardening. So, in our front yard, we have this fairly large flower garden that runs the length of the house. And then along the walkway out to the street, there's another stretch of garden there. And that's underneath, you know, two trees that are right next to the sidewalk walkway. So that entire area from the walkway and to about 6 feet into the yard is pretty much shaded all day long. And we got this little bistro set, just two chairs and this nice long table. And I've been taking my laptop out there to work every day. And boy, does that make a freaking difference on it's just like everything. Now, I don't have the dual monitor set up, which kind of stinks, but it just makes it so enjoyable to sit out there and work outside, like having that option. Does anybody else work outside?
All right. So what size is your laptop? No.
Mine's the MacBook Pro. I think it's the, what size, two sizes that come in, 13 and?
15.
15.
I think it's the 15-inch one.
Okay, because I have a 13-inch work laptop, and basically all of the screens are too small. And it just doesn't matter how you organize it. I would not be able to do, like, VMware work on a 13-inch screen. It just doesn't
matter. I can understand that. I can see what you're – are the VMware screens not conducive to being – to scrolling very well?
Well, why am I blanking on the term? The term for like being able to go phone, tablet, desktop. What is the term they call? Responsive design.
Okay, yeah, responsive design.
Yeah, so you're right. If there was any intelligence behind the design work that goes into like the VMware UI, absolutely, you could do it on your phone. But that's not the case. While the product behind the scenes works, I consider best of breed, but, the UI, it's just a frickin' horror show as far as if you don't have a 21-inch monitor.
Is it all web? Is it web-based now, or is it still like...
Yeah, so ESXi 7 is all web-based. So prior to web-based, there was an installed client, and that's actually everything other than the web UI has been deprecated. Prior to the web UI, there was what was that horrible product? The Adobe.
Flash?
Flash. Yeah, it was flash based. So it was, it was flash based, and now it's HTML5 based. So it went from installed to flash to HTML5. And as of 7, the HTML5 is fully functional and, all of the other clients are deprecated.
Hmm.
But I hate to say it. The problem is, I believe that everything is done offshore. And, you know, the same guy might work on it. In other words, it's not the same team working on the product all the time. So you probably have, you know, 20 or 30 different hands, 20 or 30 different developers working on something, and they have no idea what the last guy did. So there's no consistency from one screen to another. And I know this because I had one project done offshore that I was supervising, and it was awful. And everybody is of this mindset that you can take your product and have it developed offshore for a fraction of the cost. And yes, that's true. Now, if we talk about quality and, you know, ingenuity, see, the problem is, I think with Americans is we have ingenuity. We're like, hey, I could do it better if I do it this way, or I could do it, as opposed to reading a specification and being told to code to that specification, period. Without saying, hey, you know, we could do it this way, and that'd be a lot nicer. Whereas, you know, the spec goes overseas, and it's like, yeah, you're going to do this. It's like, well, that's stupid, but I'll do it because I know that's why I'm getting paid. And that's how things are done. And I think it's unfortunate because I think it limits, you know, the advancements that we could be having with different products. Not necessarily technology as a whole, because I think that's advancing at a rapid rate, but software products that are out there because everybody tries to economize after you have your first splash. And then, you know, the version 2.0 is done overseas and it has minor enhancements, but nothing earth shattering.
Well, okay. Since you have a lot more experience on this end than I do, obviously, because a lot of stuff that we develop, it's all completely, like, the team is there, and we might be spread out across the United States, and there might be some people that are overseas and everything. I don't have that same experience or have that same thing that you do, but I'm wondering, is it that what you're talking about is, hey, we have this team that will build this for us. We send them the specifications. This is what they're going to charge us. And when they send it back to us, that's what we get, right? It's not like this then back and forth where you're saying, hey, can we get this to maybe integrate a little better with this other part of the system? Because that's not built into the cost. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, I think when something goes offshore, there's a hard spec for it. And it's like, hey, code to this spec. As opposed to when it's done in-house by a team that's only working on the product, they fully understand the goal, and they're like, well, we could do this actually better. You know,
that goes back to administration of... Even with system administration, not even developing a product, you know, whenever I write something that I'm planning on having our Bangalore team do, I get very explicit with the instructions. I literally spell it out for them, so they literally just have to copy and paste it. Because
if you don't, it won't get done right.
Exactly. You know, because I've been burnt by it a couple times.
And half the time, even when your instructions are clear, they say, we didn't understand the instructions, so we didn't do it.
Yeah, it's to the point now when we have, if we have them do a clone, and then we kind of just did some reorganizations of our teams and the senior admins, of which there are three, and we each have what we call our affinity clients. So these are the clients that we're expected to work on more, which really hasn't happened yet, but that's kind of where we're going with that. So when they complete a clone, especially clones, we go through them with a fine tooth comb to make sure that, when they clone the system, and by cloning, I mean, they're cloning it from production. Okay. So when we go through the system, we look for any links that are back, you know, that are pointed at production, make sure that all the post-install, post-clone steps are done so that nothing in production gets updated. There's a process we have called EDX, or Envision Data Exchange, which basically is a trigger-based process so that once data, like say an address changes or something like that, then it'll send data up from one system to another. Well, unfortunately, one of those transactions also consists of sending data to the federal government. So in the name of SEVIS, which we have to do for Homeland Security. So among other things. So we had to go through it because those are the things that – it's one of those things where if I was working for an on-prem client in professional services, we wouldn't do those kinds of things because 9 times out of 10, they would say, well, we don't need to have that turned on. We don't need to have this turned on or anything like that. But we, because our online clients can't do those things that we would, they would normally do afterwards, we have to do them. So, we had to make sure they get done. And of course, there's always one or two things that the team misses. So, and then we started having some of our meetings we started having early, but I don't know what's going on with that anymore. We stopped doing that morning scrum, replace it with a workflow on Slack, which I'm like, it's like I log in and the first thing that I'm supposed to do in the morning is pop that in there. What I worked on yesterday, what I'm working on today. Well, I did that. And of course I didn't get to anything that I said I was going to work on today until about 3 or 4 o'clock. Cause, you know, it's always, can you peer review this? Can you do this? Can you do that? I'm like, yeah, sure. And in the meantime, we're supposed to be learning Git and all that. And we are eventually going to be bringing on Kubernetes as well, for a lot of our things, which I'm not sure, so sure how that's going to work. Because most of our specs are written with monolithic specs and out-of-date specs. So we'll see how that works. But
so are you going to be doing Git from the command line or Git from a UI?
Both. Yeah, we have our training had both, but it just depends on what we're doing. Mostly command line is what I would.
Well, the majority of stuff I do, you know, when you pull down a repo, you know, running a clone, I always do that by hand, you know, on the command line. But, you know, checking in stuff, I kind of like using a UI for that.
What UI do you use?
I don't know, whatever I downloaded on my
machine. I use a GitHub UI, which works with plain old Git.
For me personally, I use...
I have the GitHub desktop app. Uh-oh, I'm getting yelled at.
I use the command lines primarily because my editor of choice is VI. So.
Oh no, you're like a real Linux guy then.
So yeah, I do everything in like VI improved, and I use all the command line stuff, but we have like people I know on our team use like WebStorm, and that has like Git stuff built into WebStorm.
Right.
I don't use the UI, but I've seen it and I don't have a problem with it.
A lot of folks, since we have a lot of Windows stuff, we've been using a lot of Visual Studio, is it VS Studio, I think, the editor?
Visual free. Studio editor, that's cross-platform and free. That's kind of like,
yeah.
Like WebStorm, Atom, what is another one? JEdit is pretty robust, but I don't know if it's as robust as those.
I don't know if anybody would use Notepad++, but...
Well, that's that, you know, some people... Sublime. Sublime's another one.
Okay. Notepad++ is not a bad editor. But if you're using PowerShell or writing PowerShell scripts, then the VS Studio is definitely the way to go.
Wasn't Notepad++ written for Windows, though, and ported to Linux?
I think it was. I can't remember.
But yeah, Notepad++ is pretty cool. It's still, you know, hard to be as robust as Vim or Emacs.
Now, I will say this on my Surface, since I got the Windows 10 2004 update, which is the May update, I finally got it. I set up WSL version 2, which is Windows Subsystem for Linux version 2, which is actually pretty nice. It's a lot faster than the old version because it's actually using – in the background it uses Windows Hypervisor instead of like WSL 1 was more or less like a layer on top of the Windows kernel. But WSL 2, you know, you're actually running the Linux kernel. In fact, you get one. You download one and
you're talking about the difference between a Type 1 and Type 2 hypervisor.
Yep, basically. Yeah. So we're using, and it will enable even on Windows Home. Although I think my Surface Pro has Windows 10 Pro, I think. But it will let you use that on a. Use WSL 2 on Windows Home. And if you already have Ubuntu or any of the number of Linux subsystems from the Microsoft Store installed, you can actually convert them from version 1 to version 2 so that they run on the hypervisor instead of whatever it ran on before. So before it basically translated everything to Windows system calls, and now it's not doing that. Just running on the hypervisor, so. But it's pretty nice. Thought at some point that they were going to start integrating an X server so that you didn't have to install an X server, but I don't think that's happened. I had to install an X server to get X applications to run on it. But and I did notice the one thing I did notice is if you just installed Ubuntu, say like 2004 in Windows Subsystem for Linux. Right after you finish the setup of it, the Git client's already installed. The command line Git client's already in there. So basically, you're all set to go with Git. I mean, you can install the Windows version of Git too. It doesn't really matter. I don't know if there's much difference between the two. I mean, they both work, so. You know, I guess it's whatever you're more comfortable using. And, you know, a lot of people, there's some people will poo-poo Windows Subsystem for Linux, but if your corporate laptop is Windows and can only be Windows, but you're more comfortable working in Linux, that's the way to go. And it's better. It's going to be better and far more stable than Sigwin or anything like that. Even better than working like than setting up like a virtual box or something and working with that in a VM if you have to. It's better than that. It's faster than that. So I played around with that a little bit. The other thing I did, Atari 800 emulator on my Raspberry Pi 4. One thing I haven't figured out is how to program. Well, I don't have a joystick. I had a Logitech gamepad I got rid of. I need to get something like that if I really want to play games on it. But what I'm gonna probably look for is a USB version of the Atari joystick and get that on there so that I can play games like Star Raiders loaded right up. The only thing I haven't got working is how to control the game and sound for some reason. So I don't know why the sound wouldn't work. But I do have USB speakers plugged into my Pi. So, but we'll see. I don't know. Another thing I want to bring up on the show too is if you're at all familiar with the Arcade 1-Up machines, now is the time to keep an eye on your local Walmarts. They've been clearing out some of them specifically the my local Walmart. I have to look and see if they still have one, but my local Walmart had the Pac-Man stand-up version for $50. Now I will say this: that's probably one of the weaker ones there is, because there's only two games on it. There's unless you're going to hack it, of course. But there's only two games on the Pac-Man one that would be Pac-Man and I believe Superman. Maybe.
Why wouldn't you hack any of them? I mean, seriously.
I don't know. It just depends on if you...
The whole point of buying them is to, you know...
For you.
Wait, is that
for probably
like
most of the people
that...
Yeah, for most of the people listening to our show. What were you going to say, Dan?
Is that the full, like, when you said the stand-up, is that, like, the full arcade cabinet?
Yeah, it's a quarter scale, I think it is.
Yeah, you have to buy a stand for it.
Yeah, riser.
A riser to get it up to the right height. So.
Yep.
Or, you know, a table.
Yep. Yep. I'm actually on the lookout for it. I'd like to find a Star Wars one, because the Star Wars one has... Really, it has all three of the Star Wars games from the 80s. It has the original Star Wars vector game, the lesser-known Empire Strikes Back vector game, which was sold as a conversion to the original Star Wars game, and who would want to convert that? and it also has Return of the Jedi on it as well. That's
what a Raspberry Pi is for.
Yep.
Yeah, any game that you want on there.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, the nice thing about the Star Wars one is you actually have the actual control from the arcade game instead of having to try and figure out how to make that one work with the joystick.
They make replacements for that.
Yeah.
So you said the Pac-Man one's $50?
It was at my local Walmart.
That seems like really damn cheap for the monitor in it alone, or whatever the display in it alone sounds like. It would be nice.
Yeah. Yep. Well, you can also look at one thing I actually noticed, and this is normal price on some of these. They have a countertop based version of it, so basically you can set it up on a table. I guess the closest would be like the old remember the arcade systems they had that would sit on the bars. It's similar to that size wise. But those have been $100. And that's regular price. Yeah. And the only thing I've heard about the arcade 1-Up systems, though, has been the controls I've heard are not all that great. As in, they're a little bit flimsy.
Yeah, that's why they sell replacements.
Yeah, put a good real San Juan set in there. I'm checking in the app to see if they have any left.
Walmart.com right now to see, and no, they don't have any for $50.
Yeah, they probably what, 200 or 300, right?
Well, I'm not to the main machines yet, and I'm sorted. Oh, Galaga arcade machine with riser arcade 1-Up is currently the cheapest, and it's $320.
Yeah. Now you can, I just watched, if you ever watched Ashens on YouTube, he just reviewed something called the Evercade.
Hmm.
That's an interesting, it's a handheld unit, and what they've done is they brought out, it's actually cartridge based. So like there's a Namco Classic one, there is a Atari, like Atari 2600 game one. The only downside is from what he said is none of them, like, for example, the Namco Classic one, it's not actually Namco Arcade Classics, it's Namco Console Classics, like SNES version of Pac-Man, so on and so forth. That's the Evercade, but that's just a nice system where you don't have to deal with trying to find the ROMs and crap like that.
Yeah, $100 base price on Amazon. And yeah, you have to get the different cartridges.
Yep.
And all comes the cartridges three. Have different numbers of games.
Yep. Yep, but you can play like one of the classics that you can play on that is, oh, and it has HDMI out as well. So, one of the classics that I know is on there, I think is Pitfall and Pitfall 2, I think. So. Of course, if you have a Switch, like Dan has, you can probably download those through the console, right?
Pitfall?
Well, like any of the old school arcade games, right?
You know what?
Probably you would, play them at archive.org.
You would think that, but Nintendo's kind of a dick about that stuff. Like, they only release, like, groups of games over a long period of time. So all their, like, as far as I know, and I'm trying to think if there's an exception to this, but pretty much, like, their Nintendo 64 games and some of the, not Nintendo 64, I'm sorry, the NES games and the some of the Super Nintendo games, they have released on their, quote, Virtual Console, which is part of their subscription service. So you have to have the Nintendo Switch subscription service, which gives you the online multiplayer stuff, but also the Virtual Console. And then, like, every month or so, they release a couple of different games on there. But then it's like one or two games that they'll release, and then they'll release, like, this enhanced version of a game where it's like you get to play certain levels of that game, but not the full game. And I don't really like that, but.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they have like Zelda 2, Metroid, like a lot of their big stuff, but it's not the expansive library. I don't know if Pitfall's on there.
You guys should check out the, 1GX1.
Alright.
It's made by One Netbook. They made the One Yoga. But you can get controllers with it that fit on the side, like with, you know, what, the Wii? And, yeah. Play it like a portable handheld.
Interesting.
Even well, apparently there's an Atari Flashback Classics on the Switch, which has 150 games on it.
Well, there you go. If you want to play some of the old Atari games. See, and only old farts like us would want to play those. I mean, you know what? Let's face it, the old 2600 games were pretty awful looking, but you know what? I don't care. I'd love to play a game of combat every once in a while.
Yeah, but this 1GX1 has an i5 10210Y processor.
Thanks. What were you going to say, Dan?
I was going to say, if I was going to do this, did they have them over on archive.org, the Atari games that you could play through a console?
Some of them,
a bunch of them.
It's because I look at this and I say, oh, I would really love to play them, and then I go to play them and I'm like, oh, you know, it's worn out. It's excitement after a little bit.
Of course, now, according to the Walmart app, the Pac-Man one is still at my local Walmart for $50.
You should buy like two of them.
Yeah. I don't know about that. Yeah, my thing is space. Even on those, I know they're smaller than the typical arcade games, but space is still an issue.
So, you keep one of them stock and you do a Raspberry Pi build with the other one. You got a garage, don't you?
It's a thought. I've been toying with the idea of going up to, our Micro Center has the Creality, LD, I'm trying to remember, it's the LD20R, I think it is. The SLA printer they have for $279, which is not, I can get a better price on Amazon, but that's the extra price, the extra $50, I can go get it now, not have to wait for it. So I'm toying with the idea of it, but then I thought, but where the heck am I going to put that? Because that resin stinks to high heaven from what I've heard. And if I put it in my office, I really can't work with it in here, you know? Yeah, it's pretty much... Oh, excuse me. And the resin printers are so small. I mean, they're probably smaller than my i3 Mini, which I hardly use now. So it's like, I don't know. I don't know on that.
Oh, well, send me your i3 Mini.
I'd actually like to find a kit with a parts so I can throw, cause the newer version, the i3 Mini version 2,
has the heated bed. And
yeah.
Self-leveling?
It doesn't have that. I think it just has the heated bed. I think that heated bed and a couple upgraded things in it, like, I think it has a 32-bit controller instead of the standard, 8-bit one. I think a lot of the 3D printers started out with 8-bit, computers running the, or microcontrollers controlling the print with, Marlin usually, or a version of Marlin, their own version of Marlin, if you haven't switched to, right out of the Project Marlin, which I haven't. Just no need to. It works fine the way it is. So it's like I'm not going to screw around with trying to load it. Besides, I don't have the kit that I need to get to for whatever reason, Creality did not load the appropriate things onto the CR10 Mini so that you can just attach your computer to the USB port and flash the firmware. You have to flash a bootloader on it first with an Arduino, which I have the Arduino, I just don't have the cabling and stuff I need to actually do that, and I'm kind of lazy and don't really want to do it because it's doing what I needed to do. So you know, there's no real reason for me to flash the firmware on it as long as it's working reliably for me. I think the ID3, the Ender 3 Pro, I think, has had a price reduction, if I remember right.
Hmm?
The Ender 3 Pro.
I don't know if it's having an overall price reduction. I know that you can pick it up on sale. At Micro Center, usually at the $220 range, but I don't think that's the permanent price. It'd be nice if it was. I'd like to pick one up eventually.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. That's the other thing too. If you just plug in Ender 3 Pro, you'll see Comgro Creality Ender 3 Pro, which I think is still an Ender 3 Pro, $269.
Yeah, Amazon rarely has the Ender 3 Pro available.
Well, this
unless
one
you
is. Want
to order from China.
With the magnet, it's on Prime too.
Right. I'm looking here. I got it brought up. The Ender 3 Pro is $289. The Ender 3 is $226. There is an Ender 3 Pro with upgrade for $279.
Okay. This one's $269.
That's $269. And Ender 3 Pro 259. So 259 is the lower price for the actual Ender 3 Pro on Amazon. And I'm really surprised they have this many available right now. Oh wait, no. Here's one. 249.
I forgot, I've bought some of this transparent red, PLA.
Translucent?
That, yeah, the translucent one, the one I printed that first aid kit from. One thing I've been having a problem with it is, now usually if I get it loaded and I'm, you know, monitoring it as it's printing, it's not a problem. But like if, actually it's most often, after a print. So it works fine through the print. But then after the print, if it's just sitting there, like, you know, I turned off the printer and just let it sit there for a while, I'll come back and what happens is the filament snaps near the print head. I don't know what's going on.
Are you in a humid area?
Of course, it's Ohio.
I'm in Dallas.
Right.
It can be a problem, especially more with some filaments than other filaments. But just, you know, do a brake test every now and again. That's all you can really do.
Yeah, the transparent ones seem to be the one I had more of a problem with. And, like, I have a roll of silver that I have on there now that has been sitting on there all week. I haven't printed anything all week, although I'm getting ready to, probably.
Yeah, I printed out a couple of things today. I'm not having under-extrusion problems anymore. I replaced the nozzle again. I have, like, 50 nozzles waiting in queue right now. And so I think I'm going to find a way to clean up the ones that I think are clogged. I was testing out tree support because the other support was leaving too much material behind. But I'm not overly happy with tree support at this point.
Yeah, it's just going to depend. So...
yeah, I just got to figure out when it's better to use the tree support. Because I have had a print or two where it really did help to use the tree support as opposed to the, you know, the normal zigzag or lines.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of them, if you're using lines or zigzags, it just leaves so much material behind that even after you're done cleaning it up, it just looks like garbage.
Yep. I didn't need support at all. It just depends on what I'm printing. A group on Facebook where somebody posts something and it's obvious they didn't have supports on. They got this wicked overhang and they're like, well, can I make this look better? It's like, did you bother to read anything? That's one of the first things I learned, and that was before I even had my own printer, was overhangs don't work.
Yeah,
not without supports. You know, if you're going a millimeter or two over, if it's like a millimeter or two overhang, that's probably okay. But like, you know, if you got this nice,
in your slicer settings, you know, at least this far away from the main portion of the print.
Certain angles, yeah. There's
certain angles, yeah. And most of them come set for 50 degrees, but most of your printers will do like 60 or 70 degrees without a problem. So why not have it set to provide supports at that 70 degree angle?
Yeah.
And you'll cause less damage to your print.
Yep. Yeah. And that's the other thing too, if I got the resin printer, one of the things I'm worried about with that is just the availability of supplies with that. Yeah. The resin's actually not the problem. It's the alcohol. The down. You need the 91% isopropyl alcohol to give. You have to wash the model down, and then where do I cure it? You know, I gotta have a UV light. So it's almost like where
there's one outside.
Yeah, that's true. But in Ohio, it's not always the case. Less of a problem in Dallas, obviously. Although the 8-bit guy lives not too far from you, and he has problems every once in a while trying when he's trying to regulate things. But
well, I'd be more concerned with the mess.
Yeah, that's the other thing too. Yeah, because what are you gonna do? Because after you rinse the print, the resin off with the alcohol, it's not like you can take that alcohol resin mess and pour it down the sink. It's kind of toxic.
Not only that, but while you're cleaning up the part, you've also got the resin that's still in your printer that needs to be cleaned out as well. It can't just be left to sit there. It's got to be in a special container so it's not getting UV light and hardening.
It almost makes me wish if I wanted to jump into that instead of jumping in with the cheap one like a Illigoo or the Creality one, that's another one is Pioply. Just to go direct to something like the Form 2. Yeah, the Form 2 is wickedly expensive, but with the Form 2, I can at least get a package, where it comes with the, a wash station. Although I will say, I think the, I don't know if it's the Elegoo or the Pioply. One of them has, I have to look at some of the other ones, because another one of them has like not only a wash station, but also has a curing device too, where basically you could throw it on a platform and it'll cure it within minutes versus, you know, an hour or so outside. So, because the curing part is really important, because if you don't cure your resin prints, then they won't be solid very long. But so, and the other thing I was thinking about is what else am I gonna? I mean, the most common thing you do with those are like miniatures and really small things. And I'm a functional print, why can't I remember her name? Naomi Wu, I think is her name. I just think of the Chinese girl with huge boobs. I can't remember what she goes by on YouTube. I don't know. She's a big Creality rep. But she's like, you know, she liked it, but, you know, she's not like, you know, she's going to stick with most of her FTM. So.
Yeah, I'll stick with FTM for now.
Yeah.
And, you know, it might be that it's also 100 degrees in my garage, so.
Yeah.
The prints aren't coming out as well as I would like. But, if I have to give it a break for a month or two, I'll get out the plastic bags and seal everything up as good as I can, get some desiccant in there, and I'll wait for it to cool down.
There's also been a CNC kind of machine I'm semi-interested in. I forget the brand name, but there's one on the Amazon for like, I think it's $239. That one.
Or you,
that,
you know,
I'd have to build a place up out in the garage.
I think you mentioned it before, but you could get that 5-in-1 3D printer CNC machine for like $700.
Yeah, that thing, I'm not so sure about that. You know, because a lot of times, yeah, it's like anytime you have something that does more than one thing, is it getting good at any of them?
laser cutter. Gotta find it.
I know which one you're talking about. Yeah. Yeah. But Maybe I should just see if I can find the pad for this i3 mini. I can have both of them running. Although, honestly, the other thing I think of the one-how group, because that's what the PowerSpec one is, there have been people that are hacking the firmware and putting on extensions beyond the... Like, some of them have been figuring out how to print, because the i3 mini out of the box prints roughly a square shape. So, and out of the box, it doesn't print on the whole bed that it theoretically could print on.
Right.
All right. So some people have been hacking the firmware so it can print the whole bed. Others have been adding extensions onto the bed so it prints even larger surface areas. So, but, it gets to a diminishing point of returns, you know?
I still think you should send yours to me.
Yeah, I should fire it up again and do something on it. I don't know what. Bad part is a lot of stuff I want to print just don't fit on that one anymore.
Yeah, well, I could set that one up to, you know, print smaller stuff out of PLA,
yep.
and then set my Monoprice Maker Select V2 to do ABS prints. Either that or larger PLA prints when I need to.
I've been toying with the idea of ordering a roll of PETG, but haven't done it yet.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I've heard good things, I've heard bad things. I heard it's a little bit harder to get it to print, but if you can get it to print, then it is a lot more sturdy.
Yep. Well, and it'll take the temperature changes where PLA won't.
Right. And, well, ABS will take most of the temperature changes, too.
Although, I will say this. I had a little 3D printed cup. I probably, one of these days, should probably try and redesign it better so it fits more or less. One of the things I hate about my Traverse is that the...
I thought you weren't supposed to eat out of or drink out of
3D
printed items.
You shouldn't. Because many of them are going to be not watertight. Yeah, too porous, that too. It's basically my car, the door where you grab, where you grab it to pull the door shut. In my cruises, the two cruises I've had, that part is basically just like a little cup, you know, like as in there's a floor in it. Okay. My Traverse isn't that way. So if you go to put like your phone or something in that space when you're driving, it will just slide all the way down into the door pocket, you know?
Hmm.
So I basically designed a little cup that I can sit in that hole and then I can put my phone right there. That way it's on my left hand side. I don't look at it near as often. It's farther away from an outlet, you know, for charging wise, but still it doesn't really bother me too much, but actually reminds me too, I did pick up another USB charging battery from Rav Power, 20,000 milliamp hours. It will charge off of USB-C. The battery will charge off USB-C, or will provide power via USB-C. And can also charge off of micro USB or lightning, which was surprising. At least it looks like lightning. I haven't tried it charging off lightning. Plus it has two USB ports. And probably the nicest thing about it is it has a little couple 7-segment displays on it that tells you the percentage of charge that it has left instead of just dots.
Cool.
So, and I think it was like $40. I got it with some, guess this Monday was my 5th anniversary, and our company just switched to a point system called Bonusly, and they had a little bot, anniversary bot, and it gave me 250 points. So that was enough to get a $25 gift card. Plus, I had some that were given to me by some other teammates. So I combine all that, got an Amazon gift card, and about that. So, so I don't know if you guys have a system like that at your work, but I appreciate that my company does something like that. I'm going to get like 100 points.
They have those points. Things where you basically need to buy stuff for different vendors and stuff. Shipping giggles. I looked at Dell on some of those computers. I looked at it without the company portal and with it. And with the company portal, the prices were like, you know, $40, $50 more for like $400.
Oh, easy. Yeah.
So yeah. It didn't make sense to use it. But it's kind of pointless.
The old point system that we had, it did have gift cards, but it had more other things too. Like I got two webcams using it, a couple other little things here and there. Some add-ons for my GoPro I got that way too. But the new one's all gift cards, which I almost prefer. Gift cards, and you can also do. They can also, I think one of the things they wanted to do was they also wanted to allow you to do things like, be able to use your bonus league points to buy swag on the swag store, which we have a swag store. In fact, I just got, they just relaunched the swag store, which I think they moved from one company to another, or they either moved from one company to another, or they, the company that we use changed names or something, because a lot of the stuff that's on there is exactly the same stuff we had before. But they gave everybody in the company $25 to spend on there, so I bought a couple t-shirts. But it's nice. It's nice that today, we're working on this project to move from, two different types of Amazon hosts, and one of the things we got to do is we got to make sure that instead of using IP addresses like heathens, we're using FQDNs on everything, because yeah, it's possible the IP addresses may change when we make the moves. So if we don't change them now, then what'll happen is it won't work when we move them. So, but one of my other teammates, he jumped in to do some stuff, so I gave him some points for that. It's just nice to be able to do that and do it monetarily, kind of, sort of. But the company's money, even. So, anyway. Well, it's getting late.
Yeah, we gotta start wrapping stuff up. Everybody have a safe and happy.
Yes, indeed.
Happy 4th of July.
Enjoy your freedom while we have it.
Dun, dun, dun. All right, let me get us going here. Any last words, Joe?
Good night.
That's it?
That's it. I was just going to say words.
All right. All right, everybody. Have a safe one. Here are your promos. We'll see you in 1 week. Don't blow your fingers off. And Joel, don't blow your butt off.
Oh, my God.
It's don't blow what? Public radio.
Your butt.
I won't.
Hacker Public Radio is a daily podcast by the hacker community for the hacker community. If you're interested in technology, creative thinking, hacking, Linux, or any kind of computer, that kind of stuff, you should listen to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.com.
Hello, my name is Matt, and I've started a new podcast called LibreQuest. I talk about Linux and general technical topics. To get the show, visit LibreQuest.org.
Hi folks, this is Chatter. Jay Wisher, Haunty Magoo 5150, and I have started a new podcast.
Yeah, I know we should have gotten Brian Lunduke to do the voiceover, but he wanted a script and none of us are any good at scripting language. Anyway, it's Linux Lugcast. We're at linuxlugcast.com, IRC channel, pound Linux Lugcast on Freenode. We record on the first and third Fridays of the month, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 0200 UTC. We talk about things we've tried, things we got to work, things we failed to get working, things we built, and things we broke. Email us at feedback@linuxlugcast.com, and if we don't know the answer, we'll just tell you to install Arch. That's a joke, son. But join us as we stifle the outcry of voices everywhere for another Linux podcast.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up.
Daddy has a gun!
It's over.
While you were making egg poo young in the kitchen, I was in the dining room having sushi.
I was just looking through the games on the Internet Arcade. They don't have the ones I'm looking for. Well, I mean, they have some of them. They're pretty good. It's a good collection.
Mm-hmm.
Alligator Hunt. Look at them all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, got to upgrade 8 o'clock in the morning. Non-prod, though.
Beats having to do it like 5 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning, right?
Well, yeah. And ironically, this is probably the one they probably need this more than they need. We're going to upgrade both at one point, but they probably need this one more than the other one because there's a bug with the version that they're on. It's causing them not to be able to do debugging.
Huh.
So, because in the area of the company that I work on, our clients are still allowed to do customizations. We don't work. We're not on the. Well, we're gonna eventually. I don't know. I want to say take over SaaS, but we're gonna start taking on some of the SaaS work too. But SaaS, there are very little customizations allowed at all. My department, they're all allowed to customize it, so which is a nightmare. Reminds me, I need to send a message to my sister-in-law and see if she wants me to bake anything. Maybe make a cherry cheesecake or something.
There you go.
Or get some berries and just put some strawberries and blueberries on top. Make a red, white, and blue. And I don't know. Good night.
Power supply.
Oh. On your laptop or on your desktop?
Desktop.
Oh.
I had a spare, luckily.
Damn, it's been so long since I've messed around with a power supply.
Right.
Wow.
I knew it was kind of going for a while. It was like the fan was like on full blast for the last couple months.
I only have one desktop system.
So do I.
And it just keeps chugging along, and I'm thankful for that.
Well, I upgraded to the latest Ubuntu, and I'm pretty smooth.
I only have one classical desktop system.
Stradivarius?
I've got a Gigabit Brix, which is kind of an Intel Nook knockoff. So it's not a laptop, but not really a desktop.
How dare you try and compare your Nook knockoff to our wonderfully large-sized, plus-sized desktops.
Oh, I have a plus-sized desktop.
Oh, you do?
I do.
Okay.
Just one. It's the one I'm using as a server.
Right, okay.
There's no monitor connected to it. But it's AMD Athlon 29350 or something like that.
Oh, no, I don't have CPU info.
Hold on, I'll SSH into it.
Let's see, what do I have here? This is a genuine Intel Core i3 2100 CPU at 310 gigahertz, 3.10 gigahertz.
This is an AMD FX 8350 8-core processor.
Whoa! I only have I have 4 cores.
But it's older.
How much RAM in that puppy?
It's free base dash M. It should be 12. No, I guess it's like 16.
No, oh, you. I got 3 gigs in this thing. What a loser.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say it.
How dare you, Joe? Wait, let me double check my hard drive size.
I win.
Oh, absolutely. I have... Oh, actually, this has about 1.5 terabytes. Huh. 14... I didn't expect that.
14.75 terabytes.
Jeez! That's more storage than I've ever had in my whole life, Joe.
What are you missing?
I'm jealous. You don't have to say anything. I am.
You should be.
Hey, you know, storage is dirt cheap, but I just got nothing to put on it.
Well, yeah, I picked up that 8 terabyte spinning disk from Amazon for like 150 or something like that.
Jeez, I remember when 150 would buy you like a 10 gig hard drive,
right? But I think that's the first time I've, other than a couple of small SSDs, that I bought a drive new that I was the first owner of. Because I had the 2 4-terabyte drives, but I got those off of eBay used. And yeah, 2 2-terabyte drives before that, and a whole bunch of 1-terabyte drives before that. Damn. Right now, there's an 8-terabyte, a 4-terabyte, 2-terabyte, a 500 gig, and a 250 gig in it.
Jealous. One day, Joe, one day, I'll have all the storages.
Yep.
Just like Arby's has all the meats. Damn. What happened to Rich? I thought he was going to be on this week and tell us how he crashed his damn plane.
Did he?
That's what he said last week. Heck, where's Joel?
No. So apparently he got an email from somebody that was like, hey, you keep bringing it up, but can you refresh everybody's memory on how you crashed your planes? And he's like, hey, he asked me if it'd be okay if we should talk about it. I said, sure, go ahead. You know, it's been a while. Refresh everybody's memory how you did some stupid shit.
Was he flying drunk?
No. He crashed his plane, and then he went back and flew again.
The second time, he had mechanical problems.
Yeah. That's just... I think once would have been enough for me. I don't know.
He even cursed the second time. He set it down on a public road.
Was that the time he ended up in somebody's house?
No, the first time was a serious one. That was he crashed. I think he was coming back in, and he I don't know if he ran out of fuel, but he crashed before he made it to the airport, just outside, and he slid into, almost into someone's house. He actually went through like the front gate, like the front fence. He was on their property and like came like within a few feet of the front door. And the second one, I think he had mechanical problems. I don't know. I think he was in Arkansas, and he had to put it down on a road, a public street. And he didn't crash; he just landed.
And then he never put his plane back together.
Exactly.
Doesn't he have like an airstrip in his backyard or something? Or
no,
right?
No.
I thought he had like.
I think he had the plane was in pieces in Minnesota, I think. Wisconsin, I forget.
Oh. Hold on, I'll be right back. Look at that. Pat gave us all the information. We don't need Rich to come on and tell us about it.
Well, I can't tell whether or not he shit himself or pissed himself. I'm sure he did. The first one looked serious. That was like a serious crash. And I think he was lucky to walk out of that.
Well, Joel's going to be late. All right. Let's just start the show, I guess. Oh, let me get the Is it hot, humid up there, Pat?
It hasn't been bad the last couple of days. Like low 80s, 82, 83. Not horrible at all.
It's been pretty humid here.
Did you have like a whole bunch of thunderstorms roll through?
We had one today. It like blew through between 4:30 and a couple of them blew through between 4:30 and like 7 o'clock. But aside from that, it's been about a week and a half since we had a good hard rain.
Yeah, it's been dry up here, and 2 days ago we had like rain one day. There he is. What's up, Rich?
Hey guys, how's it going?
Crash Bandicoot. All right, man. You just made it. We were just about ready to start the show.
Okay. Yeah, I'm gonna switch headsets to a better headset.
Well, I hope it doesn't sound worse because you sound really good right now.
I need a new headset.
Really? This is good.
I mean, it
sounds okay.
All things considered, it sounds good. I just hope it sounds at least as good or better on the next one. But we'll see in a minute. So go ahead and switch.
No. If this is good, I'll stick with it.
I mean, I can hear you clearly.
I think you sound like crap.
But that's not the headset, Joe.
That's true. Once again, I wasn't going to say it, but...
All right. Joel is going to be late.
Oh, so we get to hear about crashing planes.
Dailies are here again.
Is it the anniversary? The particular reason why I like coming up?
No, he's just happy that Joel's not here.
Okay.
All right. So here we go. This. Do you know what show this is, Rich?
Oh no, I'm still eating.
Are you still eating? What do you? What is it? Is it? Is it filet with burgundy sauce?
No. Sous vide chicken breast.
Oh, where's the hot dogs? Sous vide hot dogs.
You know that.
This is 864. Here we go. Enjoy that chicken breast.